Hello and welcome, you lovely lot. Hello, my listeners as well. It's great to be back for Who Knew, a Doctor Who podcast, series four. It has begun. I've been away for a while. It's great to be back. And just very quickly before we start, and before we get to our very patient and wonderful guest, two very quick things. This is the start of series four. There'll be many, many more pods to come over the next 10 to 15 weeks, depending on how long this series goes on for. So please subscribe and like and do all of those things so that, you know, you don't miss an episode, because I've got some marvelous guests coming up, one of which is with me as we speak. And again, just another little thing, I just want to thank everybody who voted for me in the community show Whovian's Choice Awards for best podcast, because that was a very unexpected surprise on New Year's Eve. And thank you. Thanks to everyone who voted. Thank you. Anyway, let's get on with the show. I have got a banging guest to start off with, an absolutely banging guest. It is the one and only Blair Mowat. How are you?
I'm good. It's actually Blair Mowat.
Mowat. Oh God. I was going through it in my head.
Before we started.
We should. I'm an idiot.
I'm joking.
Right. Okay. Mowat.
Mowat. It's like cow. Think of it as like cow. Honestly, everyone's done it.
I apologize so deeply.
Don't apologize at all.
I have a very simple name that people don't mispronounce. It's like two four-letter words.
I had to tell Mark Gatiss that he pronounced it wrong once during a recording session when he was doing the credits for a radio drama that we were doing. And of course, everybody calls him Mark Gatiss instead of Mark Gatiss, and he has to correct people all the time. I say it to my friends, like, oh yeah, I'm doing something with Mark Gatiss. And they'll be like, oh, you're doing something with Mark Gatiss. And I'm like, I literally just said his second name as it is. And it's like you're correcting me because people think. So I remember when I told him, and he was like, Is it? No, it's Mowat. And I was like, no, it's Mowat. It's like, oh my goodness. Because he feels bad because people get his name wrong all the time.
Yes.
So don't worry.
I won't get it wrong again. The way that I won't get it wrong again is that I will just call you Blair from now on. Just to make sure.
That's nice. I think we can do that.
So let's kick it off, because why not? I mean, I think everyone listening at home will know who you are. Like Harriet Jones, you are obviously a composer. you are a composer, and as we'll get into, your career has been very closely linked to Doctor Who in many different ways over the years.
It has. It's almost as if I planned it.
Yes, almost as if you planned it.
It's almost as if I'm a Doctor Who fan myself.
Yes, well, that's a great place to start. So you're a Doctor Who fan. When did you become a Doctor Who fan? How did that happen?
So my earliest memory is a sort of cross between, I think it must have been Sylvester McCoy's era, and my father was a Doctor Who fan. He saw the first episodes. He's been watching since 1963, but he wasn't a fan in a way that he would go to conventions or sort of, you know, like swallow up information in the way that some of us would. But he was a constant viewer. He watched, you know, most of it. He's seen all those missing episodes, most of them that we will never get a chance to see, which is lovely. But he would record on VHS some of the Sylvester McCoy era, and then I would watch it. And then when I was old enough to remember stuff, I guess it was the Sylvester era, particularly with Ace, with Sophie Aldred. Mm-hmm. But then I also started getting VHSs of like Tom Baker stories and John Pertwee. So The Robots of Death is one of the earliest ones that I remember watching. In fact, there's a picture of me getting The Robots of Death on Christmas Day when I was about, I think I must have been maybe 4 years old, I think.
Yes.
Yeah, about 4 years old. And of course, that was rated a universal by the BBFC at the time. It was a U, and it absolutely should not be a U because
it has
robots strangling people, blood dripping down their hands, going kill, 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 and so it terrified me and it gave me terrible nightmares, and I was banned from watching Doctor Who for a while, which then of course made me want to watch it even more. And I was just obsessed with it. But yes, I was a child of the wilderness years in the main, despite always feeling that Sylvester was my doctor. The majority of my rest of my childhood was spent, you know, watching things on video, going to Forbidden Planet in Edinburgh, where I grew up, and looking at how woefully expensive all the videotapes were, and were just how I was never going to be able to afford to see, you know, the Key to Time or, you know, things like that. So, oh dear.
Yeah. Oh, we're blessed now, aren't we? We really, really are in terms
We're almost too blessed because there's a real majesty. It's so magic to not be able to watch it all and to have to like save up your pocket money to buy like Day of the Daleks or something like that and go along and get it and put it in. I mean, and before they released it on VHS, of course, it was even more mystical because people just couldn't access the episodes at all. The idea that you would see them again after they'd been broadcast was crazy. So, of course, people read the Target novels, and then that was the only way that they knew, you know, what happened in those episodes. And I just think that is so, the romanticism of it is just so amazing. And just to have it sitting all there on BritBox and just going, oh, well, you know, I could watch The Time Monster any Sunday, so I don't need to watch it this Sunday. And then you never watch it. So it is, of course, I don't know. It is. I wasn't part of that era where people were getting sent tapes across from Australia because they'd recorded it, you know, off TV, and then you could see stuff. But I wish that I was, because doesn't that just sound amazing?
Oh, the feeling of getting that tape after years, that would be.
But of course, the wonderful thing is that we're lucky that we have new Doctor Who, so we do still have that feeling, because of course we don't know what's coming next, and then it comes on, and then, you know, people watch it and talk about it, and so fans do still have that feeling because they get brand new Doctor Who, which is something that I didn't get when I was a teenager, and so then when it suddenly came back in 2005, I was at university at the time, and I'd sort of forgotten about Doctor Who for a few years. You know, I was off playing in rock bands and trying to be cool, and just, you know, just I assumed it was never coming back. And I was at university making friends and drinking pints, and then suddenly Doctor Who was back, and I went, wow, that is bonkers. And how amazing it was when it did come back.
Yeah. Were you in from the off? Were you a fan of the new series from the off?
Oh yeah, I absolutely loved it. Absolutely loved it. And I'll tell you something naughty that I did. There was an intranet on the university network that had all these files that people could share of things. And I remember coming home a bit drunk from the pub one day and seeing somebody had leaked Rose. And it was up months before I think it aired. Months before it aired, at least weeks. And I thought, well, I've got to watch it if it's up there. And so I sat down in a very unceremonial way and just thought, all right, I'm going to watch it now. And I did. I absolutely loved it. But I wish that I'd waited for Saturday night and sat down with the rest of the nation, because they do talk about this feeling. The reason people watch movies that are on TV, even though they have it in their DVD collection, is they've done a psychological study, and you feel like you're watching it with an audience, because you know there are millions of other people watching it at the same time, and it does alter the way that you view stuff. And Saturday night, watching Doctor Who, knowing that the rest of the country was watching it, I think is a really magical thing. And this was before BBC iPlayer, because that didn't come in until The Voyage of the Damned was the first episode to be shown on BBC iPlayer. Isn't that weird that before that you couldn't watch them? You couldn't watch them again unless you'd recorded it. It's bonkers, isn't it?
I remember, I know that Jared Groves, who's a friend of the podcast, has tweeted that he did a very, very similar thing, which I think is adorable, in that when I was a kid, I used to record the episodes on like a DVD recorder.
Right. Okay.
And then I would design my own covers for each. So you know how like you used to have the series like split into like four, didn't you? With like three episodes on a DVD. I would design my own covers, and oh, those drawings are horrendous. Eight-year-old me trying to draw Cassandra, and
oh my word.
Like I remember the werewolf from Tooth and Claw being very sketchy.
Cassandra's easy to draw because she's flat. You don't even have to do any three-dimensional stuff.
And I still messed it up somehow. I still made her look like some kind of, I don't know, sort of like a burnt lasagna, which it's not far off.
She does look like
it's
a burnt
really
lasagna.
Not that
yeah.
far off.
Yeah,
actually,
yeah,
really.
That sounds pretty good. That sounds pretty good to me. Yeah.
Yeah. So I mean, I love hearing people's stories of how they get into Doctor Who. So Sylvester's your doctor.
Yeah, he is.
What is it that is it a purely nostalgia, or if you got rid of nostalgia, would Sylvester still be top for you, do you think?
Well, he's Scottish, so you know, you sort of feel an allegiance. Well,
yeah,
to,
there you go.
And unlike David Tennant, he used his accent, naughty David. Although I love the fact that we got David using his Scottish accent. What is it? Episode two or three episodes in?
Episode two, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I straight back into the Scottish, which I thought was very cheeky. Yeah, I think it's just the first one you see, isn't it? It's imprinted on you. The first Doctor you ever watch just sort of is your Doctor, really. It was also the most current. I don't know whether my dad steered me towards that because it was the most current series as well, because they'd started using visual effects and stuff. I think Time in the Rani was the first time they'd used certain CGI to do, you know, the bubble thing going over. And that was cutting edge technology, believe it or not, at the time. So it was the closest, sort of most modern, up-to-date, I guess, sort of viewer-friendly version of Doctor Who. And obviously with Ace being the companion, it's sort of closer to sort of modern Doctor Who in terms of the template for how that progressed. So I think it was very modern for its time, that era, and particularly all the Ace stuff. But I just thought Sylvester was absolutely brilliant. You know, that mixture of comedy, but also the darkness that came into it, the mystery that Andrew Cartmel, sort of injected into the series, I thought was brilliant. And I even love the theme tune as well. I know a lot of people, you know, have their varying opinions on which Doctor Who opening they love, and of course Delia is, you know, the top for me. But I love the Kev McCulloch version. It's so nostalgic to me. It's so nostalgic to me. There's something. Yeah. It's so unbelievably weird and different from what came before. And so brazen in what it does. It's also, I mean, I don't want to get too technical, but it's also an A minor, which is really far away from E minor. So E minor is where we start. And then Peter Howell goes up to F sharp. I'm literally doing the chords on the piano as I speak. Peter Howell goes up to F sharp minor, which is only like, you know, two semitones away. And then A minor, it's so transposed. It's bonkers to go up to A. And yet it sounds amazing. So I love that era, but I think in some ways David Tennant feels also like a doctor for me as well, because I was still young enough. You think you're an adult when you're 18, but you're not really. You're still a child, and I was 19, I guess, when David Tennant was on. And he was on for long enough, because he had a long enough tenure, that time of the Russell era, when I was still at university and then sort of coming out of university, I was young enough to still have it feel incredibly magical, the fact that we had Doctor Who back on our screens, and just get really swept up in it all. So yes, he sort of feels like a doctor as well. And of course they're both Scottish, so and then of course Peter Capaldi's Scottish, so there's a real Scottish mafia in Doctor Who,
because
obviously Stephen Moffat as well.
As especially New Who, that you did like it, New Who is full of iconic
Scottish invasion.
It's great. But yeah, I love what you're saying about the Kev McCulloch theme. Great theme. I watched Remembrance of the Daleks the other day, and it's it's just every single, never skip. Never skip the Doctor Who intro ever, yeah. Anyway, because why would you? And why would you skip?
I love the visuals. I love the visuals as well. Yeah, it's so different. I don't know if you ever saw somebody recreated the Sylvester McCoy visuals. I think they did it over a couple of days or something. I remember reposting it on Twitter, and they recreated a sort of HD version of it. And it looked phenomenal. I mean, it was effectively the same, but they just you know, upscaled it.
Just lit up a bit. Yeah,
brilliant. Looked brilliant. Yeah. It's great.
Yes. And Kath McCulloch, of course, is one of the composers that is in Who Knew.
He is. He does. Corridor, he does Remembrance of the Daleks. Yeah. Yeah. It was a great score.
Yeah. He's one of a couple of composers that are in the Corridor of Fame. And speaking of composing, so of course, as we mentioned earlier, you are a composer. So where did music start for you? Were you a musical child, or were you more? Is it something that came later in life?
I was, I guess, in the sense that my mum encouraged me to get piano lessons, and I had a great auntie called Sansha Palou, who was a famous harpist, and she taught a lot of the teachers that would then teach me, and so I actually played the harp as well when I was younger. And yeah, she really encouraged me to get into music, but it was a bit more of a chore to me than a love. I didn't quite click with it. I was playing a lot of Beethoven and Bach, and I love classical music, and I love those pieces, but it sort of got part of homework, you know, really. And I didn't quite click with it until I started listening to bands. I was probably 13, 14, 15, and listening to like Blink 182 and things like that. Radiohead and Blur, and then, you know, later on Muse and The Killers and stuff. And I played in rock bands. I had a band at school that I played in, and I started writing songs for the band. And then I was doing music academically at school. So I started writing chamber pieces. There was like a music competition at school, and I wrote a piece for that. And there was a play at school, the Caucasian Chalk Circle that I did. I think it was that I did the music for, and then I started writing things that were more orchestral, you know, more akin to a symphony, and it started to become obvious that I had some kind of innate talent for composing, and I was really interested in films as well. I would make films as a child, silly, you know, sort of little horror films with my friends and stuff like that, and so I then thought of the idea to combine the two, really realized that I wanted to write music for films. And that also came about from I wanted to be a rock star, basically. And I watched,
didn't we all?
There was a, yeah, absolutely. Who doesn't want to be a rock star? And there was a Radiohead documentary called Meeting People Is Easy. And they were touring around the world and spent a lot of time in Japan, and they were utterly miserable. I mean, you know, people make fun of Radiohead for being utterly miserable anyway. But they just looked so miserable being on tour, and the sort of the repetitive nature of doing the same thing every day in this grueling schedule. And I just thought, oh gosh, that looks like a lot of hard work, and it looks quite tough, and they don't look like they're having a very good time. Film scoring sounds better. It sounds like a better lifestyle. And so I did a course. I effectively did a whole master's in 2 weeks with a guy called Hami Mann, who's this amazing American composer who came across and did a masterclass during the Edinburgh Festival for 2 weeks. And of course, it was in my home city where I grew up. And so it was very easy for me to just, you know, cycle along and go to that every day. And I did that before I went off to university to study music. I went to Durham University, which was amazing fun. And so I knew even before I went off to do my degree that that's what I wanted to do. And I'd been taught by this amazing teacher, Hummy, sort of how to start thinking about it all. And then, I mean, the rest of it is history. That led me down that path. It's so vocational as a choice.
Yeah.
That really there was no other choice. I had to stick with it.
Yeah. It's fascinating. And it's fascinating that obviously, like, you sort of started out on an orchestral route, wasn't really that into it, went to bands, and then found your way back to obviously more more orchestral music. Yeah. And that's really interesting.
Absolutely. And I loved film scores. I loved things, you know, like the early work of Danny Elfman, like Edward Scissorhands and the Batman films and the Star Wars films. That to me felt like, you know, rock music for an orchestra. And it kind of was. It was doing things that were modern and interesting and subversive, and that spoke to me more than just sort of copying what people had done 200 years ago. There was an inventiveness to film scoring that basically said there are no rules, you can do whatever you want, and actually breaking the rules is more interesting. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I loved about it. And I didn't enjoy performing very much. I enjoyed performing in the band. I sang a bit and I played guitar. Because again, there were no rules. It's like it's rock and roll, isn't it? So you sort of do what you want. But when you're getting graded on a harp exam and you're sitting there and they're watching your every move and how you bend your thumb over your forefinger and whether you've got the right technique, oh gosh, I found that dull. Yeah. Well, that's one way to take the joy out of music, isn't it? Giving you a mark out of 150 on your technique, on how you place your fingers on the strings. So yes, once I found my way out of that sort of meticulous performing, which I was never amazing at, to the point where I felt like that's something I could do professionally. You know, I was good, but I could tell that composing was a far greater strength of mine than performing, and so that's another thing, another reason it had far more interest to me.
Yeah. Well. So in terms of, so obviously you go off to university and you study music. Now, I actually want to just try and clarify your career path from this point, because I found it quite hard to research online. So I know that you I know that you worked on Doctor Who. Is that's correct? So you worked with Murray on that Russell era of Doctor Who, or was it the Moffat era?
It was the Moffat era. It was the start of Capaldi. But before that. Oh no, hold on. Yes, that was the first true Doctor Who thing that I ended up getting involved with. I met Murray at a event for composers, mingling with other composers, and he was one of the guest speakers. And he showed some of his projects and stuff and had a chat about Doctor Who. And we were chatting in the bar afterwards, having a drink with various people. And I think he could just tell, he could tell that I was a fan of his work and of Doctor Who, and that I seemed to have quite vast knowledge of it. Mm-hmm. And we just had a really good, interesting conversation. We sort of admired the same type of people. Both some of the old great composers like Ennio Morricone and some of the more, you know, contemporary ones working in the industry and stuff. And we just got on very well. So we became friends online and chatted occasionally. I shared some of my work with him. And then about a year later, he was doing about 4 or 5 TV series at the same time. Yeah. And he's, you know, composers do work with teams. It's almost impossible not to have some kind of team helping you. Just like the camera department has, you know, the camera operator and the gaffer and everyone. You need an orchestrator, you need a mixer, you need musical arrangers, people to take, you know, your themes or have a cue that you've written, a piece of music you've written, and sort of expand on that, because they don't give you enough hours to actually do the job these days. It's terrible. The schedules that we get given are horrendous. They're inhumane. And so you do have to build up a team of people to sort of help you realize that vision in whatever way. And Murray had heard some of my work, and I think there are some similarities in the, I guess, like the sort of the sentiment, the emotion, the warmth, the kind of music that we're drawn to. And I think I think we're also very different, but there is a slight compatibility there. And I knew his music very well. I knew Doctor Who very well. And he sort of said, do you want to come work with me for a while? So I did. And I had about a year working for him, and it, we started off on a show, on an American show that he actually quit after about four episodes, which was an interesting experience. And then we did David Attenborough, and like Life Story, and then there was Doctor Who, and he very very kindly got me working on Doctor Who, and it was the beginning of the Peter Capaldi era. And so I had all the episodes on my hard drive, and I think I said this on another podcast that I would follow some of the pages on Facebook of people talking about Doctor Who and what was going to happen, and they'd say, oh, what's Peter Capaldi's Doctor going to be like? And I was like, I know what he's going to be like, because it's on my screen right now. I'm doing, you know, helping arrange cues for him riding a horse or whatever. So that was a really magical experience, because it was close enough to the Russell era. You know, it was only really, I guess, a few years after that the idea of working on the show to me was crazy. I would sort of pinch myself and go, I'm such a huge fan of this show, you know, since I've been like 2 years old, and now to be just a small part of working on it was just utterly incredible. And going along to the recording sessions, seeing the BBC National Orchestra of Wales record, and having Peter dropped by and heard his theme, it was absolutely fantastic. So I did that, and then afterwards, I think people had sort of got wind that, you know, I'd been sort of helping out a bit, and I met James Goss, who was producing a new series of Torchwood for Big Finish, and he asked me to write a theme, a new version of the Torchwood theme, and then he asked me to write the score as well. And I think he was nervous to ask me to write the score because they didn't have very much money. Because of course audio dramas don't have the money that TV shows have, and I was working on things like BBC Horizon at the time in documentaries. But I mean, James is a fantastic writer, and I sort of couldn't resist, really, and then became part of that. And then the Doctor Who fan show with Crystal D that Christopher Allen produced asked me to do a theme tune for that, because of course they knew that I'd been up to Doctor Who-y stuff.
I did not know that you did the fan show theme tune as well.
I did do the fan
That's
show
amazing.
Theme tune. Yeah. And I met some of these people at the 50th anniversary. They did these screenings at the BFI of all the doctors. Each month they would do a new doctor. And I got to know, you know, people who worked on the show, people like Matt Nichols and Chris Allen and Edward Russell. And I sort of became friends with people who were involved in sort of behind the scenes or at BBC Worldwide, now BBC Studios. And we all just sort of played to each other's strengths in terms of whatever, you know, talents they had, and we love the show, we want the show to be as good as it possibly can be, and anything to do with it in the extended universe, and I think that passion really shines through. And I think it's great to be a fan of Doctor Who and to be working on the show. I think there are advantages and disadvantages, of course, but I think you just can't help but go the extra mile.
Yeah.
And you, because it just infuses you with energy and adrenaline running through your veins, to know that you're working on something that means so much to other people, and that you yourself also feel that love for the show. It's just so much motivation for having that. And that's what you want when you're doing a job. You want to wake up every day and go, oh my God, I'm so lucky to be doing this. I love what I'm doing. And I know that it has great meaning within it. And so then that led on to class as well. I mean,
yes. Yeah, of course. Got so much to talk about. So much to talk about.
Yeah.
Before we go on to class, so look, I mean, that's fascinating. I mean, just the idea of working on Doctor Who obviously is a dream to so many of us out there. It's great to hear that it's like that excitement of having like an episode on your laptop that no one's seen yet. I'd love that. So what would on say Doctor Who, for example, because obviously that's different. That's it's when you're working as part of that team with Maureen. I imagine it's very different to when you are obviously credited as the composer. And
oh, very different. Absolutely charge. Very different. It's his vision. Yeah, completely. Yeah.
So what is your day-to-day like working as part of that team, basically? What would like your day-to-day roles be?
I mean, oh gosh, it was a while ago. But I was given because there was a huge amount to be done across several things. Murray doesn't usually have a big team. He's actually incredibly fast. But it just got to a point where there were so many things going on at the same time. And so he would create, you know, a piece of music, a sort of a sketch for a piece of music that had, you know, all the elements there. But then it needs to be. So we have arrangement and orchestration. An orchestration is sort of taking what's there and being able to write it up on the page for the instrumentalists. It can involve fleshing out a little bit more in terms of how it's being arranged. But I'd say musical arranging before orchestration, you've got a little bit more latitude to, expand upon it and make some creative decisions about how that piece of music is going to sound. So yeah. I'd be adding in bits of guitar and sort of cool synthesizers and sort of inversions of chords and seeing how, you know, that's all gonna work, and then send it back to Murray and maybe get some notes back from him, like, you know, change this, change that, you know, not sure about this. And then just sort of be an extension of his brain, really. To sort of create his vision. And because I knew, I mean, there are certain very Murray sort of musical traits that I had sort of picked up on. And of course I did my research and went back and listened to things. And, you know, he loves a raised fifth, which is just a particular thing. And you have a raised fifth resolving down to the fifth. So it would be a C down up to a G sharp, down to a G. He loves that. It's a very Doctor Who type thing. If you're on a piano and you sort of try it out, that's a very sort of Murray Gold type thing. And then, of course, he uses certain instruments. He loves choir. If you've got like a horn line doing something, you've got a bit of choir, a bit of, you know, you've got an augmented fifth going on, a bit of chicka chicka. He loves a drum kit, and he loves an acoustic. He loves an acoustic guitar and a bit of drum kit behind driving it. And then, of course, people like Melanie Pappenheim, who he worked with as a vocalist. You could sort of combine various elements, and with his help and with his blueprint, you can help him sort of achieve his vision. And then there were other things as well, where I got to just do things like, I remember doing a dubbing mix for episode 2, Into the Dalek, where we all the music was ready, but we needed to send it to the execs to listen to. And I remember effectively doing what the dubbing mixer would eventually do, to just get all the levels of the music right and then, you know, send that off to Stephen and Brian to get their opinions on you know, the music, and send back notes and stuff. So there were various things, but you are there to meet the vision of the head of your team, and just get that onto the screen in the very limited amount of time that you have, because it is always a real time crunch.
Yeah, I can imagine that it's quite a stressful but fun, that is the vibe that I get from it.
It's not actually, I mean, it is it's sometimes not very enjoyable because of the stress, ironically, because of the stress and the weight of history. The larger a fan you are, the kind of harder it is, because, you know, I would wake up, and obviously we'll get on to class in a bit, but that's even more of a sort of weight of history on your shoulders. People, you see the ghost of Delia Derbyshire standing there being, you know, I did the most inventive piece of electronic music of all time. Well, the first, you know, one of the first electronically realized television themes before synthesizers ever really existed. She was an absolute visionary, and somehow you've got to match and be part of that kind of hall of fame, and you just want to do something which is as creative or, you know, as iconic as you possibly can, because the bar is set so high by the people who worked on that show, by Delia, by the Radiophonic Workshop, by some of the composers that worked on the original show. I mean, just the creativity and inventiveness was off the charts. It's part of what made Doctor Who carry on as long as it did.
Yeah, that is it's fascinating. I mean, like you said, the weight of it just feels. I can imagine how that would sort of bear down a little bit on you.
Yeah, it does. But also, it ruins the show for you, because a great example is Listen, that Stephen Moffat episode from that season 8. I remember watching that without any of the, you know, CGI or grade or any of the sound effects. And that's such a episode that relies on subtleties in regards to the post-production. It really needs all the Foley and all the sound effects and everything to be in there to give you the atmosphere, because it's all about atmosphere, that episode. And so you watch it without any of that stuff, without the music, and it feels flat. And because of course it feels flat, because it doesn't have the finishing on it. The bow has not been tied on the present. And so it's quite weird to have your first experience watching a new episode of Doctor Who be that. It's not fair. It's not fair on the people who created it, to have a fan, you know, sort of watching it like that. And it's not fair on yourself to not have the final product, because you've already seen it when it does come out on TV. So of course you can enjoy it, you know, watching it a second time, but you don't know the twists and turns that are coming, and you don't get to experience that final package of how it's meant to be presented. And of course it then becomes part of your work and part of the stress in your life. And then it gets all sort of muddled up into that. And you know, they say you know, there's all these memes about, you know, if you want to sort of keep loving your hobby, then don't turn it into your professional day job. And, you know, I think there is some truth to that, because it, you know, we don't want to be working 24/7, do we? We want to be doing other stuff. And sometimes when a job is as intense as that, you can begin to resent the fact, or your partner or your friends might resent the fact that they're not seeing you as much as they would like to. And you know, that becomes part of your whole life. So yes, it's definitely advantages and disadvantages to sort of realizing a dream like that. Mm. But, you know, once you've done it, or once you've got over the other side of the hill, looking back is amazing. I got the chance to be part of that in any way is fantastic. And there's obviously no regrets on that side.
Yeah. Good. But yeah, it's weird to think about, like, what, like you said, like watching an episode of Doctor Who for the first time, but without the music, because it's like those moments that you were talking about, like the big twists and the turns, like it just elevates it, doesn't it? Like, it just feel like,
oh, absolutely.
You don't realize
absolutely
when you're watching it, but I imagine it would.
And if you're doing, if you're watching an episode of Class, and instead of the Shadowkin, it's a man in a green suit with a tennis ball, you know, it's not the same. Well, of course you're not going to be able to buy into the imagination of what's going on, if that's what's presented on screen. So yes, it is very different. It is very different.
Yes.
But it's also magical, absolutely magical as well.
Of course. Let's talk about Class, because
sure.
Class is something that, if I'm honest with you, it's fascinated me for quite some time, because it sort of came in a time where, you know how you said, like, when you were like in your late teens, early 20s, and I feel like there is that moment where you sort of, you don't, like, I still adored the show and I'd watch it every week, but it wasn't what I was thinking about 24/7, which,
wow, you get
it
distracted.
Is now.
You get distracted by other things.
Definitely. And Class, in terms of my age, sort of hitting that point. So it sort of, I didn't get to it. I think I basically missed Class.
You weren't the only one. You weren't the only one. There's quite a few people who missed it when it was on. it wasn't marketed very heavily, so I'm not surprised.
It wasn't, shamefully, very heavily. But it's something that I feel like in the fandom, being part of that, it's had a bit of a revival recently in terms of people discussing it and people rewatching it. I've just recently dipped my toe for the first time. I'm still within class because I've only seen the first episode.
Okay,
but
right.
I am, and I've seen clips here and there out of context, unfortunately, because that's what happens when you're five years late to a TV show, yeah. Josh. But loved episode one, actually. I really enjoyed it. How did Class come about? Because it's quite a strange pitch for a Doctor Who spin-off. But it works. I think it works because I think having this disconnected story within this world is something that people have sort of cried out for a while. Because obviously you've got Sarah Jane Adventures and Torchwood. They sort of follow a similar formula of a character from the show and we follow them.
Yeah.
And that works and it's great. But I was chatting to some people at the BFI the other day, and we were saying, like, we just want to explore this universe more and meet characters that we don't really know and races that we don't know that aren't connected to that main bit or just loosely connected. And that's where I think Class is a really fun idea. So how did it come about and how did your involvement in the show come about?
Well, I think that's really interesting that you were having that discussion and that people were talking about wanting that, because I don't think they did want that in 2016. I think the reason people want that now is that they've seen what Marvel, what Disney have done with Marvel and with Star Wars. And that's a really interesting idea now. But back then, because there wasn't much of an expanded universe going on in Doctor Who, we didn't have the Sarah Jane Adventures anymore. Mm-hmm. We didn't have Torchwood on screen. I think a lot of fans were really annoyed that if there was going to be a spin-off, that it wasn't something like Madame Vastra and Jenny and Strax going off and having Sherlock Holmesy adventures, you know, in the Victorian era. And of course, people, you know, wanted Torchwood to come back and things like that. So I think there was a lot of animosity against Class because they felt like it was denying them of something else. And I don't think that's true because, of course, I know how politics and how things work within the BBC. And it's just that was the show that was right to be made for the various, you know, political reasons and things at that particular point in time. And I think we're really lucky to have somebody as amazing as Patrick Ness as a writer, having come in and dipped his toes into the world of Doctor Who and given that to us. And I think rather than being angry about what people feel they should have had, just celebrate the fact that there's something, you know, glorious and interesting in the world of Doctor Who that got the chance to come onto our screens. And I think one of the reasons that people are happy to go back and there's been this revival of people rewatching it and people like yourself checking it out for the first time is because I think we're now in the mindset of just thinking, gosh, it's great to have more in that particular universe. But I think that was maybe part of why there was a kind of contentiousness when it first came out. How I got involved in it was I saw the announcement. It was actually my birthday. I was having some birthday drinks in the pub with various friends, and I saw that there was an announcement that there was a new Doctor Who show to be coming out, and I read the Radio Times article, and I thought, oh, it's been announced on my birthday. This is very fortuitous. This is a sign. Yeah. I must do the music for this show. And, you know, I remember reading it on the tube on the way home, like kind of scouring the article for information. And it was very scant on information. There was very little about it. But they, there was enough just to get a bit of an idea of what it could be. And so I knew Brian Minchin, who was the exec producer from Doctor Who, because I'd met him at the recording sessions when I would go along with Murray to record the orchestra in Wales. And so I sent Brian an email and I said, do you know what you're doing about music? I would love to do this. And Brian said, we don't know what we're doing with music yet. And, you know, I said to him, I wanted to send him a pitch. And he said, I'd love to hear a pitch and, you know, definitely forward it on to all the appropriate people and have a listen. And so I sat down for a couple of weeks and I didn't have a script. I didn't have anything to really go on apart from this Radio Times article. And so I kind of invented in my head what class might be like.
Yeah.
And I wrote a sort of opening sort of credits type thing, which, I mean, it wasn't really, it's kind of an opening credits type thing that then morphed into a kind of bit of score and then had a sort of outro thing. And it was a 90 second to 2 minute pitch of a sound world. It was basically just presenting a musical style that hadn't really been done in the world of Doctor Who, that was a bit more synthy and guitars, very sort of modern feeling and younger as well. You know, it felt a little bit more like something that had been created in a studio by a band wanting to do a film score, rather than, you know, sort of the more traditional orchestral style that had sort of pervaded the Doctor Who universe up until that point since it came back. And I sent it off, and then, you know, Brian said, thank you very much. You know, we're still casting, you know, we're not even really properly thinking about music, but, you know, this is great to have. And then months and months went by waiting to hear if there was any chance. And it got to a point where there were actually other people inquiring about my availability. And I needed to really sort of say, you know, like, if you do want me to do this, then I need to, we need to do it now. And so I ended up going for an interview in Cardiff, and they pulled me in to speak to Derek Ritchie, the producer, and Brian and Patrick. And I had a conversation with them. And then, basically about a week later, after they'd heard more of my previous work and we talked about the pitch and the vision for the show, Derek called me up on a Friday early evening and said, you've got the job. And I said, and they knew that I was a fan. Derek's a massive fan of Doctor Who. He absolutely loves Doctor Who. Huge, huge Doctor Who fan. You should get him on your show. He's fantastic. Yeah. And I said, oh, Derek, that makes me very happy. And I just remember him going, I thought it might. Because he knew, he could tell there was an infectious enthusiasm. Because I was just so enthusiastic about it. I thought it was so exciting what they were trying to do. But yeah, I think, you know, that obviously appealed to them. And they knew that I knew how Roth Lock worked, like as a post-production facility, the timelines, what Murray had, the pressures that Murray had to work under. They knew that I understood that. And they also were willing to take a punt on somebody, because I was relatively young, although I started my career very young, so I had had quite a lot of experience. But it was still a kind of like making it moment for me. You know, it was an 8-part high-end BBC drama with the same budget as Doctor Who at that time. It was a huge deal, but it was a show about young people. You know, it was all newcomers. I think they wanted to take a shot on somebody new. And they had just enough information to kind of go, we can trust that this isn't going to mess up. We have enough to know that this is going to be okay. But it's still a little bit of a risk.
Yeah.
Because, it always is working with somebody new that you haven't worked before, that, you know, is a certain, more at the beginning of their career than the end of their career. But I managed to convince them that wasn't an issue. So it was great. It was a great process.
Yeah, I bet. And I must say as well, though I have only, and it's a little bit naughty. I don't know. Is it naughty to listen to a soundtrack before you've watched the thing? I think maybe
not at all. I do it all the time.
I do it all the time.
People say to me, have you seen that film? Be like, no, but it's a great soundtrack.
Great soundtrack.
Love the score.
I've listened to quite a hefty chunk of the Class soundtrack.
Oh, great.
And it's sort of been the soundtrack to my week leading up to this recording as well.
Oh, brilliant.
And I love it. I really, really love it. Because, just to touch on what you said there, because I picked up on it and I thought this myself as well. Like you said about how it's obviously it feels a bit younger and it feels like a studio band or something like that.
Yeah.
When I'm listening to it, and funnily enough, a couple of bands that you mentioned earlier at the start that you were into came to my head. I was like, it's got little aspects of Radiohead. It's got a little Muse bits.
It's quite a heavily Muse bit at one point. It just sounds like a Muse. I had to work quite hard to make sure I hadn't ripped them off. Yeah. I was like, this must be a riff that it feels so obvious. It feels like they must have written it before. But yeah, that was quite a Musey riff. Yeah.
Yeah. Because I'm a massive Muse fan. I've loved Muse for years, and I've always thought Muse and Doctor Who just makes sense. Like it does. I don't think it'll ever happen. I don't know if it can't really work. It doesn't really work, does it? Like the concept, but probably not
in this universe. No,
not in this universe. But it just makes sense.
But the grandness, the grandness and the spectacle and the sci-fi-ness of Muse, I think that could lend itself to the score and those elements of it that were an influence on my own musical voice, and definitely the musical voice of Class as a score. You know, there is like 5% Muse in there, and it works, because of course it works because they are so sci-fi and they are so epic.
Yeah, this feels like the closest thing to getting a Muse Doctor Who soundtrack, which I was like, it's far enough away that it's not like you said, it's not ripping off Muse in any way, because obviously you've still got the orchestral stuff, and you've got those lovely reworkings of Murray's motifs from Doctor Who. I love the way that he did some of that. I just think it's a great soundtrack. It's really, really good.
Thank you. Yeah. And I spent a lot of time thinking about, because we did a bonus CD of other music because the fans wanted to hear as much as possible. But I did that. I split it up into, rather than doing a double disc, I split it up into like the main soundtrack and then the bonus CD, because I wanted that soundtrack to feel like, you know, it was the greatest hits, and you could listen to it as a soundtrack and it would really, you know, really entertain you. If you went for a walk for an hour, you know, it could really entertain you on your walk, and you weren't going to be skipping tracks all the time. And I remember listening back to some of the very, the early Doctor Who releases that Murray did, where I think he combined seasons one and two maybe, and they re-recorded some stuff for orchestra. And I prefer that to having everything, you know, just sort of laid out over like, you know, three discs or something. I think it's great to listen to a soundtrack as an actual CD like people used to do. It's not as common these days, but to actually listen through, I wanted to give people that opportunity to listen from start to finish and to feel like it actually was a record in itself, a soundtrack. So that really is music to my ears. To hear you say that is really lovely. So thank you for saying that.
Yeah, no, it definitely works like that. And it screams that I'm a terrible skipper. I get a playlist full of songs that I love, and I shuffle. Yep. Because in my head I'm like, yeah, I want to mix it up, and then I'll sit and I'll skip until I get to a song that I want to listen to. Why didn't I just put the song that I want to listen to on rather than shuffling it? but I didn't skip once. Everything just flowed beautifully into one another, and like I said, it just became the soundtrack to my life.
That's great. And it is chronological. Like the album is presented, you know, episode by episode, from episode 1 to episode 8. So despite the fact I had to find a way to keep it chronological and yet still make it feel like a record. But it is the journey of the series. It's the journey of watching Class, listening to that record, because of course it takes you from episode to episode until the very end, until the end credits. I'm glad you had that experience.
Yes. And I mean, I can only say that it's a shame that there were, like, as it stands at the moment, obviously, don't know what's that there isn't a second series of Class on the way, as far as I'm aware, to get another marvelous soundtrack as well.
I think it's unlikely to do another TV series of Class, just because of people's ages, really. I mean, the age when you're 18, 19, 20, and then, you know, however many years later it is now, gosh, what is it? Oh, God, 6 years later, almost? Well, five and a bit. Yeah, I mean, they'd have to be at university. You'd have to have skipped everything that happened in between. So I don't think it'd be possible to do it as a TV series unless you were to do something quite interesting with it. I mean, they did that with Buffy. They went off to university. So there's no reason why you couldn't do that with Class. I think it's still unlikely. Of course, on audio, how they look doesn't matter.
That's what I was going to say. So, in the meantime, Big Finish will always provide what the dreams of fans. They'll always provide that extra series that you always wanted, which is lovely.
they had a license for 12 episodes set within season one that was agreed before Class never got a season two. And so they assumed that it would go, I mean, everybody assumed it would go on to a season two. It's very odd, a very bad, unlucky course of events that sort of really sort of led to that. You know, most of which were nothing to do with the actual show's production itself, but to do with BBC commissioners and politics and things slipping through the cracks and being kind of between eras as well. I mean, it was the end of Stephen's era, and really. So it was just unlucky in a way. But yes, there were currently, and, you know, at that point, coming to the end of those 12 episodes, there were currently no plans to renew it, to do a season two. But of course, things can change, and I think all the actors, you know, would be quite keen, and there is absolutely the possibility of that, and people should hold on to that possibility. It's not impossible that there will be more Class on audio. It doesn't mean that there will be, but it's definitely a strong possibility that somehow one day that might be able to work itself out.
Wonderful. Well, we're going to take a very, very short break, but when we come back, we've got, finally, I'm so happy to have my features back with me.
Brilliant.
After so long away from the pod, but I've got my features, the feature king return. I'm not the feature king. Oh, look at me bigging myself up. Yes, we've got some features. And Blair has got some very interesting choices to make. So we will see you on the other side. Welcome back to Who Knew, a Doctor Who podcast. I'm still your host, Josh Kerner, and I'm still here with the wonderful Blair. This that's it now. You are Blair. You are like Cher and Adele.
It's because you're too afraid to pronounce my second name again in case you get it wrong.
Mowat.
There you go.
Like
there
Cowet.
You go.
Yes.
Like Cowet.
It's time to head on over to a wonderful, wonderful place. As you can see, right behind me is my DVD collection. But it's time to head over to the shelf for the DVD collection.
By the power of Grayskull.
The Unicorn and the Wasp or Love of Monsters?
Which one do you think I prefer?
No, I mean, which one do you want to watch first?
You are pulling my leg.
Ooh. So, the DVD collection, for any new listeners out there, is a collection of what I would describe as quintessential Doctor Who stories submitted by my wonderful guests. There's a vast array of Doctor Who stories, some incredibly deserving of the title, and some slightly questionable choices along the way. But we love them all. We love them all dearly. So Blair, what would you like to submit? What story out of all of classic and new Who would you like to submit to the DVD collection?
Well, yes, I mean, this sort of depended on what was already chosen, really. And I'm a big fan of a subversive choice, and so I was tempted to go with something a little bit more controversial or quirky. But actually, in the end, I saw that there was one that wasn't there and that I really love as a story, as something that I watched when I was a child, and also it has a absolutely cracking score. Musical score, which I think is one of the greats of the classic era of Doctor Who, and so I have chosen Earthshock in the Peter Davison era. Peter Davison Cyberman story, four parts. What? Earthshock.
What a beautiful pick! And yeah. Might I say, I don't know if you know this. This may be completely intentional. I believe either today or yesterday, 40 years since Earthshock aired.
I think
it was yesterday or was it today? I can't remember.
I don't know if I did know that. I think I saw somebody post something about 40 or a while since something. Oh, yes, there was something about Adric. And so it's very, that's a very apposite choice because, yes, it is 40 years since that Adric classic ending. Yeah.
How beautiful. It is today. I've just checked. It is today. 40
years.
Actually,
today.
Today.
This is,
as
this
we're recording.
This is a phenomenal choice then.
That is, what a fantastic choice. So Earthshock, obviously amongst Doctor Who fans, regarded as I think it's safe to give it the title of a classic.
Absolute classic. Yeah.
Absolute classic. Yeah. As you said, great soundtrack.
Yeah. Malcolm Clark, who also did the Sea Devils, just phenomenal inventiveness and the weirdness of the sounds, the march of the Cybermen, the kind of doom, 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 which then would, of course, you know, sort of come in the idea of them marching later and sort of in New Who. Just the creepiness that is injected into that score by Malcolm Clark is really, it's adds to the atmosphere of that episode so much. So yeah, no, yeah, great score.
Yeah, great. And a lot of important moments in Earthshock as well. I mean, one being, I can only imagine the feeling 40 years ago today, of people still reeling from
spoiler. You want to give a spoiler alert, just in case. If you haven't seen Earthshock and you don't know what happens at the end of Earthshock, then go and watch Earthshock now. Why on earth are you listening to this podcast if you haven't seen Earthshock?
Exactly. Even I have to endorse that message. Even I endorse that. Spoilers for something that is 40 years old.
Yeah. And then come back and listen to the rest of the podcast because we're about to have, you know, an interesting chat about Earthshock. Yeah.
Go now. Quarry. Cyberman. That's what we're getting to. Part one, that cliffhanger. Oh, it's a joy. It is just one of those brilliant moments. And I can only imagine what it was like to have the Cybermen away from screens for so long, because that's the first appearance since Revenge, isn't it? I'm pretty sure.
Yeah. I think so. Yeah, and of course we hadn't hadn't had a Cyberman story in the John Pertwee era. And it's not as if we got loads in the Tom Baker era. And so the Cybermen, would be really, there was a Cyberman drought for quite some time. And then to suddenly have them come back, and imagine watching that in 1982 and not knowing that they were going to suddenly appear on the screen, being a fan, or even just seeing, not even knowing who the Cybermen were and seeing them for the first time. I love that design. Mm. I think it's so iconic. It's so weird with the cricket gloves and stuff like that. But it doesn't detract. You never look at it and think, oh, they're wearing cricket gloves sprayed with you probably will know that I've said it. Mm. Sprayed with silver. But it's just a great design.
It's great. And it's only enhanced by David Banks with an excellent performance.
Well, that's it, because they're not meant to have emotional voices. They're meant to be like, I am a Cyberman. But yet there's something so cool about them being, I've got a big emotive voice, Doctor. it just works for some reason.
It almost breaks every rule in the Cyberman playbook, and it works. And I love that. I love it. And then right at the end, spoilers again for big things that happen, you've got the death of Adric, who in my opinion is possibly one of the most underrated companions. I love Adric. I understand why people might get irritated by Adric at times.
He's a little bit annoying at times.
He's a bit annoying at times.
He's good in that episode, though. In Earthshock, if you hadn't seen, some of the other ones, and I think in Earthshock, he's on fantastic form. That's what a moment. What a moment in that ending.
Great exit. And that shot at the end of the badge. Is it a badge of mathematical excellence? Is that
something like that?
Like that.
Yeah, and no end titles music either.
Great
choice. That might have been the first time they'd ever done that, and killing a Doctor Who companion. I mean, I don't think they'd done it up until that point. I don't think killing a companion, as far as I'm aware.
Again, spoilers for something that is nearly 60 years old. I think you had Dalek's Master Plan. There was Katarina, but she'd only been around for a few weeks, I believe. In terms of a full time proper companion,
you weren't expecting it. You weren't expecting it, were you? And the thing that I love about Earthshock as well is I feel like the pacing of the directing is very modern. One of the problems with watching sometimes old Doctor Who and trying to get like a friend or a partner interested in it is sometimes the pacing is just a bit antiquated because things were slower back then. If somebody went up to go to the door and walk out the door, they went up to the door and they walked out the door and then they came back in again. And there was a bit of dead air because of the way that, television was shot, because of the audience expectations. That was just the style of the time. Mm-hmm. And we're a lot tighter in what and how we edit stuff now. And I think it can be a bit of a challenge showing people older Doctor Who sort of getting into that. And I think they sort of lose patience a little bit. But the wonderful thing about Earthshock is that whenever it is slow and brooding, it's there with a purpose to create an atmosphere. That first episode is really creepy and it is a little bit kind of slow and brooding, but there's still a lot going on. And episode 4 is just, it's all guns blazing, it's so much happening all the time. It's just so tight in the way that it was directed. It's a proper action thriller at that point, and there's a sense, there's a brooding threat of how this is all going to turn out, and of course they know making the episode how it is going to turn out, and I think that atmosphere is seeded into the entire story from the start that something terrible is going to happen, and then it does happen despite all their best efforts, and that just gives it this incredible shape as a story, I think. And then you've got Peter Davison at the height of his powers as well. I mean, he's just incredibly heroic as the Doctor, showing incredible emotion. You've got a fantastic guest cast as well. I mean, it just, it really is. It deserves its Hall of Fame classicness.
Yes, and it is on the shelf. So Earthshock, welcome, the first of series four. What a beautiful start. What a great start. Pure classic. So, I'm very happy with that. Very, very happy.
I think it's relatively well known amongst some fans as well that Beryl Reed, who played the captain in that, was quite drunk for most of her shock when she was filming it. So it's also good to watch it back and try work out what level of drunkenness she was. It didn't affect her performance in the slightest. but it's a fun game, especially if you're watching it as a drinking game yourself.
Yeah, just rewatch Earthshock and just watch Beryl Reed, and you'll have a great time.
She's trolleyed. I mean, I have to say, I don't know if that is actually 100% true, but apparently, from various sources, along the lines of Doctor Who rumors, she was trolleyed.
Yes,
for most of that.
To stop me from getting sued by the Beryl Reed estate, allegedly.
Allegedly, if I was surrounded by Cybermen, I'd probably have a whiskey too, to be honest, to calm the nerves.
Definitely, 100%. So that was the DVD collection. Again, wonderful pick, but it's time for, I think, a little bit of a grilling for you from our wonderful listeners. I think it's time for a fellow Scot, Mr. David Tennant, to lead us into the next segment, which is Bloody Twitter.
For God's sake! Bloody Twitter!
Bloody Twitter.
Should not do a Scottish accent in front of a Scotsman. I've learnt my lesson on that many a time. So, I have a few questions. We got loads of questions from our listeners. Ooh. So thank you for sending these in. If we don't get through them all, I do apologise, but I've cherry picked some good ones. So the first one from one of our dear listeners, a dear friend of the show, Cal at generic_tweeting. He started off by saying, "Just wanted to say that I'm a huge fan of your work, especially the class end credits theme, which ended up in my top five on Spotify Wrapped."
Thank you, Carl.
Yeah, which is amazing.
I probably received about 0.23 pennies for all of your listens, and I'm very grateful and very grateful. Yes. I won't spend it all at once.
That's a shame. So please send Blair a check to make up for that in the post.
No. Just lobby Spotify to actually pay the people on their on their service properly.
Yes, yeah. Definitely. He has asked, what is your favourite track that you've composed?
Ever? My favourite track ever?
Yeah.
How do you choose from all your darlings?
It's a hard question. Yeah.
Because we're talking about class, and Carl will appreciate a class choice. I like Charlie Laying Down the Law from the class soundtrack, which is from episode 8. It's later on in the album. And I just, to me, that is a kind of the epitome of what the class score became. You've got some solo violin interacting with a bunch of analog synths. You've got some double track guitars, crashing away halfway through. It's such an odd mixture of instruments, even though themselves, that wouldn't be a remarkable choice to use those particular instruments. The fusion of all the different elements. I remember listening back to that and thinking, if somebody heard that and they'd watched Class, they would just remember that must be from Class. It just feels very, very, and of course it uses, one of the themes that is seeded throughout Class. And I do come back to it, you know, on occasion, and I sometimes include it in show reels if I'm sending stuff off for another project. And yeah, I think that's just always stayed with me as one of my favorites. So I'm gonna choose that one today. I might choose a different one tomorrow, but today I shall choose Charlie laying down the law.
Great pick. And Cal's actually snuck in a second question, but I'll allow it.
Cheeky Cal.
Cheeky. Cal has said, is there a big Finnish range that you haven't composed for yet that you would want to in the future?
A range?
Yeah. Ooh. And obviously there's a million different things, because Big Finish do so much.
They do. I don't think there is. Because I think a lot of my it's quite hard to keep up Big Finish at the same time as working on the TV work that I do. And so because of that, there are so many other people working, talented people working at Big Finish, and I've been working there for quite a while. I say there like it's a physical place. I mean, I'm actually just doing it in my studio. I don't go to Big Finish to compose my scores and then go home.
They make you sit on the 95 bus. And
a lot of my love for sort of being there so long is working with people like James Goss and Scott Hancock. And the amazing work, the stories that I've had the chance to work on, and just being bowled over at how great the quality of both the sound designers are phenomenal at Big Finish, and the writing on the projects that I've worked on, I've just been bowled over by how good it's been. And so I think the reason I've stayed so long doing Big Finish is because of that relationship, really, with people like James and with Scott. So I won't say another range, but I'll say Class Season 2, which isn't a different range.
Yeah, there we go.
But it would be a slightly different range from the volumes already released. So we'll say that.
Yeah, definitely. Great pick. The next question is from Jamie at A Madman Not a Box, who's asked.
Oh, I know Jamie. I've never met him in person, but he is. We have talked to each other on Twitter quite a few times around Class being on. Big Class fan, Jamie.
Yes,
we love Jamie.
Jamie loves Class. I've noticed that from following Jamie. And Jamie has actually said, I think Blair has been asked every question imaginable about Class by me. So instead, I'll go a touch more general and ask, what's been the most interesting instrument to incorporate into a piece you've created?
Because it's Jamie, and because he's such a big fan of Class, I will choose two class instruments. The first one is the glass harmonica. If you type it into Google and see some images of it, it's a beautiful instrument, cylindrical glass instrument that you wet your fingers with water and you use your foot on a pedal to turn it round, and it creates a kind of like very mystical, ethereal sound. And we used that in Class in episode 7. And there is a fantastic player that we got to, I'm trying to remember his name. We'll come back to that. Who did a brilliant job of that. And I used that when I did a version of the Doctor Who theme that James Goss asked me to do for the Unbound universe. And I used samples of a crystal harmonica to do a version of the Doctor Who theme, because originally Le Structure Sonores, which Verity Lambert asked to do a version of the Doctor Who theme and turned her down, were known back in 1963 for using the glass harmonica. And so part of my Unbound universe idea was that in this universe, Verity Lambert managed to convince them to do a version of the Doctor Who theme.
Oh, I like that.
And so I used the glass harmonica to do that, but I also based it off Delia's arrangement. So it was a kind of weird parallel universe where Delia probably went over and jammed with them to create, I think they were based in France, to create this new version of the Doctor Who theme in that universe. So we use that in episode 7 when there's an alien planet in episode 7. Don't want to give too many spoilers since Josh hasn't seen episode 7 yet. But there is an alien planet, which is good fun. And there's some glass harmonica in that. And the second one was a one-stringed instrument that I found in the back of a guitar shop in Soho, which I bought and was determined to use on class. And Jamie, I'm sure, already knows this, but was determined to use it on class because Delia Derbyshire, when she did the original Doctor Who theme, created it using a custom one-stringed guitar-esque instrument. And then she sped the tape up and down to create the eventual recording that we heard. Wow. And we don't really know what that instrument was or what it looked like. And that's always been a bit of a mystery to me to want to know what that was. So when I saw this, I bought it, shoved it into a guitar amp, got a cheap violin bow, and I did the shing for the Shadowkin when they're marching along. It goes like shing, shing. That's me bowing that instrument, going into a guitar amp, being recorded. And that became part of the iconic sound of the Shadowkin. And that was a love letter to Delia, also using a one-string guitar instrument as well. So yeah, there you go.
Beautiful, beautiful. That's a great answer. Jack Coyer, 1966 on Twitter, asked, what instrument is best suited to Doctor Who?
Ooh, that is... I'll tell you what instrument is not best suited to Doctor Who. And I think that's the theremin, because everybody thinks that the theremin was used to do the original Doctor Who theme, and it wasn't the kind of woo. And so people think it that naturally is a sort of Doctor Who instrument when they think of it. And actually, I think it's incredibly hard to use the theremin well. It is possible, and I have used it in sci-fi scores, but it can come across as a bit sort of hammy. Unless you've got a really good player, and they are hard to find. So I think people think of that and associate it with Doctor Who, but actually, it's never. I don't even know if it's ever been used in Doctor Who.
No, I must say it's weird, isn't it? Because the when I read that question, I thought, "Oh, theremin," but I knew it wasn't used. And I'm struggling to think of an example of a theremin ever being used. It's weird, isn't it? But it just, I feel like, because it seems like something that would be in Doctor Who, that it's that kind of weird. The fact that you don't have to touch it, you just move your hands around and noises come out. It's a very Doctor Who-y concept, and I like that. So maybe
it
that's
is a very
why.
Doctor Who concept. I think the best instrument to use in Doctor Who is finding a way to use an instrument that hasn't been used in that particular way before, or finding something that isn't an instrument and finding a way to use that as an instrument. Because I think Doctor Who is incredibly creative, and the Radiophonic Workshop did amazing work using music concrete, which is using like everyday sounds to make up sound design and score. And in honor of them and the work that they did, I think finding ways to innovate rather than relying on an existing instrument is something which is more in the spirit of how Doctor Who started. Mm-hmm. So not a specific instrument in general, but more a concept and an ideology. The brain is the instrument. The Doctor is always a fan of using their brain to get out of a situation rather than other means. And I think using that to kind of come up with something which is unique and idiosyncratic and original is always the best option. That's the best place, I think, to start.
Perfect. Perfect. And we'll make this the final question. As I said, if we didn't get around to yours, I do apologise. But this is a question from dear friend of the show, a dear friend of mine, and about 6 months ago when I put a tweet out saying, who would you like to see on Who Knew? My friend Peter, at Dalekium on Twitter, suggested you. So it's one of the reasons you're on the show. I mean,
thank you.
You were on
thank
my
you,
list
Peter.
already. But An incredible composer themselves as well, I must say. Dalekian.
Oh, wonderful. Wonderful.
Incredible Doctor Who work. So they have asked, if you were approached to write for Doctor Who, would you do it?
I think the answer to this always depends on who is showrunner, who approached me. I mean, if somebody like Russell were to approach me, then I mean, if Russell approached me asking me to do a version of the phone book and he just copied and pasted, you know, the phone book into a Word document, I'd say absolutely. I would do it. I think he's a fantastic writer.
Yeah.
And a lovely, lovely person. So if somebody like Russell approached me to do it, then I think it would be very hard to say no. If depending on who else was doing it, who knows? It really depends what I was up to myself. Part of it depends on availability. Mm-hmm. What do I have, you know, going on, continuing series? But it's always been something that I've been very interested in. There's no mistake that I ended up doing the music for Class and, you know, for the Torchwood audio series. I love Doctor Who with all my heart. And if I felt like a particular era would benefit from me giving my love of the show to it with somebody who I felt, you know, shared a vision with what they wanted to do, then it would be very hard to say no. I would love to write the music for Doctor Who. At some point.
I mean, someone asked, and I resisted the urge because I knew I wouldn't get an answer, and I'm never going to get a clear cut answer to this question. You could be lying either way, but actually, a few people asked, and I've seen a few people mention, because obviously the idea of Russell T Davies picking a composer for his era of Doctor Who a few months ago would have been out of the realms of possibility. It is now in the realms of possibility in this wonderful world that we find ourselves in. And
he's coming back.
Yeah, he's coming back. And your name does come up a lot. And
I've seen that in my Twitter mentions and I ignore it every time.
Yes. And someone did ask, will you be the composer for Russell's era of Doctor Who? Obviously, if you were, you're not going to tell me. And if you're not, I'm just going to think you're lying and that you are anyway. So this is a lose-lose situation for everybody.
Exactly. It is a lose-lose situation. Yeah. We've got, Russell's already stated publicly that he, I think, you know, it's going to be next November, isn't it? He said he was going to do the November where the first episode was going to go out. So that is, it's a very long time away. There's other Doctor Who to happen. We've got the Sea Devils coming next. We've got a centenary special coming later in the year. And then we're going to have, you know, a bit of a long wait by the looks of it until we get to that point. So yes, I think anybody who was even thinking about it would be encouraging everyone to just sort of enjoy what's left. And then once passing through that threshold, start to think about the possibilities of what might happen next. But you're right that either way, I would not give you an answer.
Yes.
So it's kind of a pointless question.
It is a pointless question, which is why I didn't ask it, and now I basically asked it anyway.
I am happy to say, because I don't like to, you know, comment on those posts and sort of feeds fuel rumors either way. But you know, as I've said to you, I love Russell, huge fan of his work. Russell and I do speak over email occasionally, and he is aware of my work, so I'm sure he would know that I would be a keen bean. So I can say that at least, you know. I think he's fantastic, and I'm, you know, whether no matter how I would end up watching it, I'd be so excited to see what he's going to do in his return, because he is the godfather of modern Doctor Who.
He really
and
is.
I think it's absolutely terrific that he's back, and he's going to do. He never fails to do something absolutely marvelous. And so I'm sure whatever is coming our ways on our screens next year, it's going to be spectacular. So yes. I'm just excited about the fact that he's back in the chair.
Yes, me too. I think a lot of people are. Obviously, I know that you, like you said, you don't comment on it because, you know, it fuels fires, and then you get news outlets picking up on things, and I don't really mind that,
to be honest. Yeah. It's probably no bad thing for my career to have a Daily Mail article saying, you know, he's doing the music for it. I just think it's kind of not fair on the current era of Doctor Who to be talking about it too much. And so I think, you know, before they have finished, you know, putting their heart and soul into the finishing touches of what's yet to come, you know, I think we should just, because there's going to be that big gap waiting for, you know, what does come next, I think that's the time to get really excited about that. I mean, and just enjoy. I mean, you know, gosh, the Sea Devils are coming back in next month in April.
Yeah.
You know, and I love what they've, and we've only just seen a picture of it, but I love what they've done with the design.
It's great, for them,
because it looks so similar to what they did back in the 70s. And I love how authentic they've been with that, but while still giving it a bit of a modern twist. So yes. Who knows?
But yeah, obviously a lot of people that I've seen would love you to be in that role. So that must be nice to hear.
It's very heartening. Yes. And, you know, I mean, Doctor Who will hopefully be on for a long time.
Yeah.
And hopefully I'll be around for a long time.
Oh, of course you will.
I'm only in my 30s. So who knows what could happen? I mean, it's, you know.
There's plenty of time.
A long life for Blair, a long life for Doctor Who. So who knows?
Yeah, who knows? I think what you've confirmed there is that you'll be writing the music for the 100th anniversary special in around about 40 years' time. You'll be there and you'll be writing the music for it. So there you go. There's the scoop. I mean,
yeah. Maybe I'll do the 80th and then I'll do a Russell and I'll come back for the 100th. Yeah. When Netflix doing a co-production of it, or the new Netflix.
When it's just streamed directly into our brains. Wonderful. Well, that was Bloody Twitter. Thank you, everybody, for submitting your questions. You're all ruddy marvellous. And we've got one thing to attend to before the end of the show.
Right.
And that is the Corridor of Fame.
Have you ever been limited by who you were before?
One day, I shall come back. Yes, I shall come back.
Our lives are different to anybody else's. That's the exciting thing.
Dear Sarah Jane,
do I have the right?
For some people, small, beautiful events is what life is all about.
It's an anniversary compared to us. 10 million years of absolute power. That's what it takes to be really
powerful. Every great decision creates ripples. Like a huge boulder dropped in a lake.
But it was a childish dream that made you a doctor. You dreamt you could
no more.
I'm not just the time. I'm the last of the time.
It just disappears, doesn't it? Everything you are, gone in a moment, like breath on a mirror.
I do what I do because it's right! Because it's decent! And above all, it's kind!
Love abides in the face of everything.
So, again, for new listeners, I'll give a brief recap. The Corridor of Fame is basically a completely original concept thought of by me. No one has ever done any kind of Hall of Fame before. It's all from my brain.
That's amazing.
Obviously. You know, that's amazing. It's great to see a mind like this at work, isn't it?
I'm joking,
of course. I've ripped off an age-old concept of a Hall of Fame with a Doctor Who twist. So obviously people involved in and around the show, and even people not directly involved in the show, can be submitted by my guests to be hung up in a lovely golden framed portrait on the Corridor of Fame. So Blair, who would you like to submit to the Corridor of Fame?
How many people am I allowed? Could I cheat and have like a few people? or is it just one?
It's got to be one.
Can I have a duo who often work together as a pair?
I think. Well, the last episode in which we had a Corridor of Fame, Pete Levy, one of the producers of Flux, came on, and he did submit a duo because I feel like he explained that you couldn't really separate Verity Lambert and Waris Hussein,
right,
as a combination. So, I mean, I'll allow it.
Okay.
Go on.
Well, I mean, they didn't work on the classic show, but because they are such good friends of mine, and I work with them on such a frequent basis, and I've already mentioned them before on this podcast, but I have to select James Goss and Scott Hancock, because James is a phenomenal writer who's mm-hmm. who's done all sorts of, you know, Doctor Who novels and audios, and he worked on Time Fracture, which was yeah. So I mean, you know, it's what hasn't he worked on? What hasn't he worked on? And I just think they do so much hard work under, you know, quite constrained budgets in comparison to, you know, a lot of the televisional stuff. And of course, Scott mm-hmm. did. I think Scott worked as a production assistant on Doctor Who itself as well. They've both been very intertwined in the world of Doctor Who, and I thought mm-hmm. it would just be quite exciting to choose, because I know a lot of these people are sort of that have been chosen have been classic producers from back in the day, many of whom you know aren't even with us, and I just think, you know, they're closer to the start of their career than they are the end, and I'm really excited to see what's to come from them both, because every time, I've said it earlier in this episode, when I get those scripts that come through from James Goss for things like the Torchwood audios, he's just such a phenomenal writer. And I really hope at some point he's going to write a TV episode of Doctor Who, because I would love to see him. I'd love to see him do that. And Scott as well, I just think, what an amazing director, amazing writer. He's the Swiss Army knife of talent. I mean, what can that man not do? And they're both just so lovely. And I think one of the loveliest things, one of the best things you can have in your working life is to work with lovely people. And no matter how sort of stressful things get, whether there's deadlines or various issues, they just both keep their cool. They do such an amazing job, and they've given so much to the Doctor Who community through their hard work and their innate talent. And more often than not, I'm working with them as a pair, often with James producing or writing or script editing, and Scott directing, or sometimes having written himself. And of course, Scott and I did the Class audios. He was directing and producing those as well, those first four volumes. I think they've given a lot, and I think they've got a lot left to give. And so as a duo, I'd love to pop them in the Hall of Fame.
Well,
I think it will age very well.
It will. And, you know, that is a great pick. I'm going to squeeze them both into that frame. They're going to have to do like a push together selfie to go in the frame. But they will both go in. So James Goss and Scott Hancock, great picks. I agree with everything you've said. And I agree. It is nice that, because obviously we like to, I like the Corridor of Fame, because some weeks you'll get like your Verity Lamberts, who obviously at some point Verity's going in because she deserves it, and she's it's waiting there for her. And then sometimes you get the unsung heroes. But this is something slightly different. It's someone who is, like you said, at the start of their career coming up. And again, they are, it's a testament to them both that they're both so early on in their career, and they've 100% both done enough to earn a place.
To warrant already being in there. Exactly.
You just imagine and
it's
what
nice to celebrate.
Do,
It's nice to celebrate people when they're alive, isn't it? Because as soon as somebody dies, Twitter is just full of people celebrating the life that they had. And just wouldn't it be nice to see all that before you died? And so before they die, which I hope will be a very long time from now, ladies and gentlemen, James Goss and Scott Hancock, what a fantastically talented pair of people who deserve your celebration today and forevermore.
Wonderful. Wonderful picks. And with sadness, that brings us to basically the end of the show. It's been absolutely marvellous. I've really, really enjoyed it. I do have one last question before we leave, which is a question that I ask everybody at the end of every podcast. And it always trips people up to start with. But it always brings the best answers. In a sentence, or two, or three, or four, whatever you want.
Yeah.
What does Doctor Who mean to you?
The thing that I found most marvellous about Doctor Who was that, as a child, it gave me a moral compass. My parents were not religious. I was not religious growing up. And if I find myself in a situation, in the playground or in my life, with a moral quandary, I would ask myself, what would the Doctor do? And that was usually the right answer. And so I think that is an amazing thing, growing up on a show where you can say that.
Yeah. Beautiful. Beautifully answered. Oh, well done. Well done. Because it's a tough question.
It is a tough question. And I got a little bit nervous there when you were saying, oh, it always trips everyone up. And I didn't know that was coming. I did dip into, I listened a bit to one of the podcasts, the Sophie Aldred one that you did, because I think she's brilliant. I got about two thirds of the way through it last night because I thought, oh, I'm doing this podcast tomorrow. I must go and check what's the format of it. So I'm looking forward to finishing that off and hearing her answer. But yes, good.
Yes, very, very good answer. And a slightly, if you'll allow me a joke, a slightly concerning answer for someone whose favourite Doctor is Sylvester McCoy, because usually the answer is genocide.
dinosaurs on a spaceship. Matt Smith kills somebody at the end. What is it? The guy who plays William Hartnell in the, what's his name?
Oh, David Bradley.
David Bradley, he's in that, isn't he? And then I think the Doctor kills somebody at the end of the episode, which I always had a big problem with, is spaceship explodes. And I'm pretty sure it's almost a direct action of what the Doctor does. And I thought, that's not what the Doctor would usually do.
What would the Doctor do, apart from in these very particular episodes?
He doesn't usually murder people. It's usually by accident. There's a lot of death that surrounds the Doctor, but it's usually very indirect. And it is true that if he hadn't shown up, a lot of people probably would still be alive. Actually, no, that's not true. Because usually there's something terrible going on that he saves a lot of people. But yes, usually 99.9%.
Yes, you are correct. As a mantra, it's definitely it's definitely very, very good, and it's definitely better than others. It's good enough for Yasmin Khan as well. So that's wonderful.
Indeed.
So again, that brings us to the end of the show. Blair, it's been absolutely wonderful chatting to you. I've had a whale of a time. Before we go, please, obviously everyone knows who you are, but plug away. Plug anything that's coming up for you, where people can find you. Whatever you want.
Well. I mean, well, you can find me on Twitter. Bloody Twitter. at Blair Mowat. And I'm on Instagram as well. You can just search for me. And in terms of things that are coming up, I can't say, actually. I've yet to sign... there's some things later on in the year that are in discussions. So I can't really say anything. Can't plug anything at this particular point in time.
Very mysterious, as we said before. Exciting. Very excited to see what you do next, because, as I said, you are a wonderful composer.
And oh, thank you.
I have everything that I've heard that you've done, I've loved. So very, very, very excited. And again, thank you, everybody, for listening. I've now got to do my spiel, which, I can't remember. You, in terms of where you can find the podcast, you can subscribe to us on YouTube if you search Who Knew a Doctor Who podcast, where you can get video versions of every podcast that's released. And you can
Know that. I should have been looking more at the camera.
Am
I going to be on screen?
I mean, if that's okay with you, maybe I should have mentioned that.
I'm glad I tidied up the studio. What if I was picking my nose?
But yes, you can find video versions of every podcast, which is news to both you guys and Blair. And you can listen to us wherever you get your podcasts, so any podcast platforms. You can find us on Twitter at Who Knew Podcast, on Instagram at Who Knew DW Pod, and you can even send us an email if you want, whonewdwpod@gmail.com. There's also a Patreon if you want to support the podcast, help keep the lights on and the mic on. I would really, really be grateful for it. I'll drop links in the descriptions for the tiers, but you can get early access to podcasts and even a nifty little Who Knew pin badge, which some people got gifted for free at the BFI the other day. So you can get little treats like that. And as well, there's the Who Knew merch store, so you can get t-shirts. And the Patreon gives you discounts. So happy days all round. There will be plenty more pods to come. So please like, share, subscribe, all of those wonderful things. Pass the pod. And I will continue to bring you marvellous guests. So Blair, thank you once again for joining me. It's been wonderful.
Thank you very much for having me on. A pleasure.
Pleasure. And to everybody at home, goodbye.
Goodbye.
Big thank you to all of our patrons, and a massive shout out to Alfie Innes and Cal King. Thanks for listening to Who Knew, a Doctor Who podcast. You can check us out wherever you get your podcasts and now on YouTube. Please subscribe and leave us a review wherever you can, as it really helps us out. And a massive thanks to the Sononauts for lending their cover of the Doctor Who theme to be the theme for the podcast.